Hey guys, welcome to the Anchored Hope podcast. I'm Pastor Mike, the lead pastor of Anchored Hope Church, and I hope that while you're listening today to our podcast, you can join us on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. at 211 Boone Street. We'd love to have you. We hope that this message is encouraging to you, and we hope that you can also join us at our location at 211 Boone Street. Also, check out our Facebook page and our website, www.anchoredhope.church.
We are wrapping up next week our series, it's not new anymore, but our series, Some Assembly Required. And what we've been talking about is how to build the family, how to assemble the family that we want to resemble, right? And the family dynamic, marriage, having kids, parenting, from afar, it looks like it's easy. You know, we see it modeled to us or we see it on TV and we go, yeah, I'll take one of those. I'd love to be married. I'd love to have kids. Shoot, I'll have five of them, right? And then you get into it and you're like, okay, this is going to take some work, right? And that's the thing. Just like whenever you buy a piece of furniture, looking at the model, looking at the perfectly formed, fully put together version of it, you get it sent to you and it turns out there's some assembly required. And that's what happens in the family dynamic as well. It takes work to make a marriage work. It takes some work to figure out this parenting thing, and nobody's perfect at it. And so I've been giving you guys some tools, but what I want to do this morning is kind of help you think a little bit outside of your current context. Because a lot of you, in your family context right now, you think of, okay, I'm a mom and I'm a dad, and you know, my kids, they're this old, and this is our family dynamic. You know, it's just the four of us, it's just the five of us, it's just the two of us, it's just the three of us, whatever it may be. You're probably right now stuck kind of thinking about just this context and just this number of you that are underneath your roof, right? But I want to help you a little bit, think a little bit past that. Because how many of you, and you should kind of catch on to where I'm going with this, how many of you have grandparents? All of you do, if you don't know, okay? Even if they may not be with us today, all of you have grandparents, right? Let's try this again. How many of you have great-grandparents? Raise your hand. Again, all of you, all right? Let me help you. See, you're really stuck. This is going to be good for you today then, okay? You all do. You all have a family history. And some of them you may have never met. You may not have known them, right? But regardless of the fact, they did have an impact on your life. The generations behind you, this is going to be on the screen, the generations behind you had an impact on your family today. They did. Even if you didn't meet them, whether you know it or not, just think about that for a minute. The generation behind you had an impact on your family today. My grandparents from Texas are here today. They wanted to come see the building and to deliver presents, obviously. But they drove here from Dallas, Texas, and they're here today. And in my family tradition, so we have a cookie. It's like the Davis cookie, okay? And there's one way to make it, and there's one cookie, and that is the M&M cookie, all right? And I'm not talking about the Keebler elves have nothing on my mama, okay? We make it mama's way with mama's recipe. It was a staple to every visit, every time, every summer, we'd go stay with my grandparents, my sister and I, Brianna, and we would go, and it was just a matter of time before they said, what do you guys want to do? And we were like, make your famous M&M cookies, right? And so my grandmother has passed this on. She taught my mom how to make the cookie, right? And then I got married to Kate. Now, when I got married to Kate, Kate said, can I introduce you to my family cookie? I said, sure, honey, we could try that. And so she introduced me to her family cookie, which was the oatmeal cookie. And so the next time my grandmother came, I said, please fix this woman, right? And so my grandmother taught my wife the M&M cookie, and thank the Lord we don't have to eat that oatmeal anymore. And so, and then just yesterday, you know, I know anybody whose family who comes to see me, they're really here to see the grandbabies. And so they were here to see their great-grandbabies. And so they taught Olivia, my almost four-year-old, how to make M&M cookies yesterday. So her and Mama got to get in the kitchen, and we went to, you know, Kroger and got all the ingredients and stuff. And, you know, my grandmother was land-blasted. Why I don't have flour, sugar, or anything else. I said, Mama, have you seen this lately? Okay. But we went and got all the ingredients, and they made M&M cookies, and it was really, really fun, and it was awesome. But it goes much further than that. I remember my dad telling me a story, and I called him about it this week to kind of refresh my memory. But I called him this week, and he always used to tell this story. He's a pastor, and so he would always tell this story about my grandfather, my papa, who's here today, they moved to Greenville to work for a company called Safeway. Ended up being E-Systems. And he worked for Safeway, and he had a reputation for being honest, for being on time, for being a hard worker. And so my dad, when he was a teenager, he went to interview at a grocery store called Brookshire's. And he went and interviewed, and when he was there, one of the guys from the baking department walked by and saw the interview being taken place, and the guy who worked in the baking department had worked with my grandfather, my papa. And so he stuck his head in, and he said, "Hey, that's Hugh's boy. If he works half as hard as Hugh does, he'll do a great job." And my dad got the job because of the reputation that my papa had. And I remember that didn't just stay with my dad. My dad taught that to me. I remember there was one time where I had a job as soon as I turned 15. And so I remember there was this one time where we had a teen lock-in with the youth group. And what happened was is I had to work the next day, but I really wanted to go to the lock-in. And so I told my dad, "Hey, Dad, I really want to go to this teen lock-in, but I have work tomorrow. I tell you what I'll do. I'll just call in sick tomorrow." And I remember my dad saying, "No, that would be a lie, and that's not who we are." And he just kind of made that clear right there that, no, we don't call in sick when we're not sick. That's a lie. That's wrong. That's not who we are. And I said, "Okay, well, fine. You know, I'll bargain with you. I'll go, but then I'll go to work tired. It's fine." And my dad said, "No, you're not going to do that either. You are a hard worker. You're a Davis, and that's not what we do. So here's what you're going to do. You're going to go till midnight, and then you're going to come home, and then you're going to get six or seven hours of sleep. And then you're going to go to work, and you're going to give them your best effort, and you're going to be rested, and you're going to do your best, because that's who we are as Davises." He instilled that in me, and we never lied, and we always worked hard, and we were always on time, and they passed it on to me. And that was passed on to me because it was passed on to him by his father, and I'm sure my papa was taught that by my great papa. There are these things, these traits, these characteristics that were passed down from generation to generation. And that's the thing. Every generation behind you has an impact on your family today. So here's what I want you to think about. Right now, you only think about your family context in the context that it's in right now. But did you know that one day, most likely, you're going to be grandpa? Just think about that for a minute. Okay, you're 20, you're 30, you're 40, whatever it may be right now. One day, you're going to be grandma and grandpa. One day, you're going to be great-grandma. And you're going to be great, Grandpa. One day you're going to be long gone, but there's going to be a legend about you. There are going to be stories that are told, things that are passed down, where your kids say, "Why do we do this?" And you share the philosophy, or you share the method, or you share the reason why you do what you do, and it will be attached to your legend. Here's the bottom line right here. One day, you're going to be legend, wait for it, dairy. Legendary. If you laughed, you saw that show, okay? You're going to be a legend. One day, you are going to be a legend, and your legend is going to be told. So here's my question for you. What do you want that legend to be? Think about it. You're stuck right now in your context, but one day, you're going to be a legend, and they're going to tell it. What do you want that legend to be? I think a great story that illustrates this point in the Bible is found in the book of Genesis. And I'm just kind of monologue the whole story for you because it takes up about two-thirds of the book of Genesis. But you really got to understand what happened first and then kind of what happened last to understand everything and to kind of get the understanding of what fully happened. But it has to do with this huge, huge family that all started with Abraham. You're going to see the family tree up here, kind of explain it to you. Maybe you've never connected this before. But the family tree, it started out with Abraham, right? Many of us know of Abraham and the promises that God gave Abraham. Well, Abraham had a son named Isaac. And Isaac had two sons that were actually twins, Esau and Jacob. And although they were twins, Esau actually came out first. So he was the firstborn. He was technically the oldest. Now, at this point in time, this is very, very important because whoever the oldest or the firstborn son was, they received the blessing, which the blessing was the inheritance, okay? So they were going to get substantially a lot more, almost 2 to 4 times bigger than what Jacob was going to get. Esau was going to inherit all of Isaac's fortune, all of Isaac's land, all of Isaac's cattle, everything that there was. And Jacob was not going to be left for much just because Esau came out a little bit ahead of him. All right? Now, we're going to come back to this a little bit later because it's very, very important. But Jacob ended up having 12 sons. Can you imagine what it took to assemble that family? All right? He also had four wives to get it done, but he ended up having 12 children. And in that 12 children, one of them was Joseph, right? And many of us, we've heard the story of Joseph before. And Jacob loved Joseph. Joseph was actually the favorite. Joseph was partially favorited by Jacob because he, of the four wives that Jacob had, Rachel was one of his favorites. So Joseph's mom was one of Jacob's favorite wives. But also, too, Joseph, who was 17 years old about the time that we read about him in Genesis, he also had this great gift of interpreting dreams. And he was also, you know, this is always a parent's favorite, he was also a huge tattletale on all of his brothers as well. And his brothers would be up to no good, and he'd go check on them, and then he'd run back to Jacob, and he'd be like, "Dad, do you know what they're doing again?" And this really irritated all of the brothers. As a matter of fact, there's one point where Jacob gives him a robe, a coat, to kind of honor and celebrate him, you know, the coat of many colors that you may have heard of before. And so he gives him this coat to kind of honor him and praise him, and all the 12 brothers are really sick of this. And here's Joseph, he's standing out, he's 17, he's a little snitch, right? And what happens to snitches? They get stitches, right? We are definitely in Troy when you can, you guys can't quote scripture, but you can say that. All right, so it's cool, we're that kind of church. So one day, Joseph goes off to find his brothers, and he can't find his brothers. His brothers are somewhere where they're actually not supposed to be, and he goes after them, and they see him coming, and the brothers go, "You know what, I'm so sick of this," and one of them says, "Let's kill him. Let's kill Joseph. Let's just end ourselves of this riddance and get rid of him." And one of the brothers says, no, we can't do that. He has a little bit of mercy. And you know, that one sibling who's like, let's be nice to our little brother. Let's think of something better to do than kill him. And then he says, "You know what we ought to do? Let's just throw him in a hole and let him rot. Let's do that." And the brothers are like, "Good idea. That's much more loving," right? So he comes, they grab him, and they throw him in a cistern. And you know, they just start eating their lunches outside the hole, just waiting for him to just kind of, you know, they're just like, "Oh, feels so much better to have him down there." And he's down in this cistern, and he doesn't know what's going to happen. He's in this hole, and his brothers are just planning on leaving him there. And then all of a sudden, a caravan of slaves come by, and they're on their way to Egypt. And they go, "You know what? You know what would be so much better than just letting him rot in that hole is making some money off of this guy." So they're like, "Let's get him out and let's sell him into slavery." And that's exactly what they do. They pull him out of the cistern. They make a deal with the slave traders. He headed to Egypt. And they go, "Here, please take this." And they trade off for him, and they get paid for giving their brother away. And they end up going back to Jacob, and they tell Jacob that he died, that there was an accident, and that Joseph was dead. And they brought back the coat and his clothes, you know, with fake animal blood on it and stuff. And so Jacob believes he's dead, and Joseph ends up going into slavery. When he gets to Egypt, he's now a slave, which is a terrible, terrible, you know, sentence to have. There was no way out of it. There was no way to gain his freedom, but he did luck out somewhat. I should really say he was blessed, because he ended up under a government official by the name of Potiphar, and Potiphar had a lot of power, and Potiphar ended up really, really liking Joseph, and so he actually gave him kind of all the power of the household. He let him manage all of his affairs, and he made him kind of the head slave over everything. But there was one problem. Joseph is 17 years old, right? And he is looking good, right? I mean, he is Evan Hudson level of good looking. I mean, he's got the hair, he's tall, he's handsome, he's muscular, you know, and like his dad. And so Potiphar's wife takes a little looking at him, and she's like, "I like this, right? I like this slave." And she actually tries to entice him and tries to sleep with him. And what's really, really interesting, you know, we don't know exactly what's going on with Joseph, Maybe at some point he started to doubt his relationship with God or get angry at God or wonder why this was happening to him. But something that he says to Potiphar's wife tells us that he was still keeping his relationship with God intact, that he was still focused on what God wanted him to do and didn't give up on God. And this was his response to Potiphar's wife. It says, "No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" So his first argument is this: look, girl, you're married, all right? And I don't do that. I got a good deal going on here, and Potiphar, I like my boss, and I'm not going to do that. But his biggest argument, the biggest thing that he says no to, is that that would be a wicked thing, and I would end up sinning against God. See, most of us in that context, in that situation, would go, you know what? I got a bad card handed to me, right? I got a bad deck. I don't like this. You know what? Whatever juice comes my ways, I'm going to squeeze that lemon and I'm going to take full advantage of it, because I hate this life and I need a good time. And I, you know what? If she's offering, I'm going to take it. But no, Joseph, he was still connected to God. He still wanted to do the right thing, even though things weren't going right. And so he told her no. And so guess what she did? She claimed rape. And she went to Potiphar and she went to the officials and she staged this whole thing and she said that Joseph had raped her. And so Joseph ends up being put in jail. So here he is. He gets an even badder deal. Now he gets thrown in jail. And when slaves were put in jail, there was no trial. There was no justice. There was no chance of ever giving out. They were pretty much left down there to rot. And so there he sits. But God was still with him. The scriptures say this next. It says that God was with him and he showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So he's got that going for him. Great. He's sitting down there. He's rotting in jail. But hey, the prison guard likes him, right? But then one day, Pharaoh and his leadership team, they have a bad meeting. Things go wrong. He doesn't like what they say, and so he throws the leadership team in jail. Can we bring this back? No, I'm just kidding. But he throws his leadership team in jail because he doesn't like their response, and they think that they're going to die. They think that they may be sentenced to death and be rotting there with Joseph. But one of them, the cupbearer, he has a dream. And what is Joseph good at? What's his talent that God has given him? He's good at interpreting dreams. So this guy wakes up and he has no clue what's going on. And these guys kind of meet Joseph and befriend him a little bit. And Joseph goes, "I can tell you what your dream means. Actually, you shouldn't be worried. Actually, what that dream means is you're going to be put back in right relationship with God. Things are going to be okay. You're not going to stay here. You're not going to die here. He's going to call you back. You guys are going to mend this thing up and things are going to be better." And so they got really hopeful and the cupbearer was like, "Oh, great, awesome. I'm going to make it out of here. Things are going to be okay. I'm going to get my job back." And Joseph goes, yeah, that's great. "Hey, can I talk to you for a minute? When you get out of here, can you remember me? Could you maybe, you know, tell my gift, my talent to Pharaoh, maybe get me a job, maybe see if there's a place for me among you, you know, like, hey, you know, I kind of did you a favor. Could you do me one back?" And the cupbearer's like, yeah, sure, no problem. I'll do that, no doubt. And the cupbearer gets out, and guess what happens? He forgets Joseph. Doesn't mention Joseph's name, totally forgets about it. 2 years go by. Joseph is still sitting in prison. And then one day, Pharaoh has a dream. And Pharaoh brings his leadership team together, and nobody can figure out what it means. Nobody understands it. Pharaoh knows it's very, very important, but he cannot interpret the dream. And the cupbearer goes, "Oh, hey, you know what? Hey, you know what, Pharaoh? Funny thing, you remember that time we had that little tiff? Let's not talk about that. But when you threw me in jail, again, not worth talking about, I met a guy, and he was actually really good at this thing." And so they go and they end up going and getting Joseph and pulling him out. They clean him up. They make him, you know, proper to be in front of Pharaoh, the king of this empire. And they bring him in front of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh tells him his dream. And Joseph very quickly is like, "Yeah, I got this one figured out. I've got it. See, there's this dream. What it means here is that you're going to have 7 years where your crop is going to be very plentiful. It's going to be great. Things are going to be so awesome. You're actually going to have more than you need. And things are going to be great. But here's the thing, another 7-year term is coming where there will be a famine and there will be not enough. You will have nothing and everything will be very, very bare. And so you need to get ready for this. God is giving you a message to prepare for this time in your life and in your empire. And so Pharaoh, here's what I think you should do. And this was amazing that Joseph had the guts to look at Pharaoh and not only interpret his dream and say that it was a message from God, because Pharaoh, he thought of himself as a living God. And he says, my God above, he's trying to warn you and give you a message. And hey, while I'm at it, let me give you my advice. Let me tell you what I think you ought to do, right? I mean, this is very, very gutsy. But he says, here's what I would do if I were king, is I would take these 7 years and I would build silos in all the major cities and I would save as much as you could. Actually, what I would do is I would put a 20% tax on everybody, and 20% of what everybody brings in, I would take them as the take it from them as the government. I would store it up in the silos, and then we would have enough stored up for those 7 years of famine. Everything, we would have enough and we could actually sell it back to them. So he pitches this big Shark Tank moment, right? And everybody's looking at him, and everybody's writing it down. They're like, man, this is really, really good stuff. And nobody knows how Pharaoh's going to react. And it says that Pharaoh loved the idea. Everybody was like, that is awesome. That's a great idea. You know what? That would be great. Everybody would have enough. My empire would be taken care of. I'd make a little money. This is a good deal. And so he says, man, if we could only find somebody who was smart enough, who had the business savviness to be able to pull this thing off, if we could just find somebody to kind of lead this area, that would be terrific. And they look at Joseph, and this is what he ends up saying to him. He says, the plan seemed good to Pharaoh and all of his officials, so Pharaoh asked them, can we find someone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God? And then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. And so he gets the job. Awesome. He's not a slave anymore. They clean him up. They make him look like an Egyptian, you know. They put eyeliner on him. They give him a big, you know, headdress thing. They give him some tattoos. He's walking around half naked, all tan and bodied up, right? He's awesome. He's an Egyptian now. And he's Pharaoh's second-hand man. I mean, next to Pharaoh, he has the most power in this huge empire. He has gone from being in a cistern, sold as a slave by his brothers, to now the highest-ranking official in Egypt, next to Pharaoh. So, just as he predicted, just as God told him, 7 years go by. Joseph has a great job, everything goes planned, and then eighth year comes, and guess what comes? The famine, just as the dream had been told. And so people start to go hungry, people start to be in need, and so they end up going to these, you know, major spots where these silos were, where all of this food was, you know, saved up, and guess who ends up coming to town? Joseph's brothers. Says next, a little later on in Genesis, says, so Israel's, that's Jacob. Jacob changed his name to Israel. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for there was famine in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all his people, all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces on the ground. This was 22 years later from the moment that they threw him in that cistern and sold him into slavery. I mean, think about how good you'd be feeling inside, right? 22 years later, that time where your 11 brothers threw you in a hole, wanted to kill you, and then sold you into slavery, put you through all that misery, stole your childhood, stole so many years of your life away, and now they show up, and not only do they show up needing your help, they are bowing down at your feet, wanting mercy. Pretty sweet spot to be, right? Pretty cool. Probably would make us feel pretty good. Probably for most of us, with that much power, Joseph could have done anything under the sun that he wanted. He could have thrown them in slavery. He could have killed them. He could have thrown them in a cistern. He could have done anything that he wanted. But what happened next is probably a bit unexpected. And some of you may even know the rest of the story and what happened. But the question that I have, and that what I want to connect for you today, that you may have never connected, because it never connected for me until I saw somebody else tell it to me, is why did Joseph do what he did next? And it all goes back to the beginning of the story and what happened in his family line. Let's go back to that family history. So remember what I said, Esau and Jacob, twins, born at the same time. Esau, born first, so he was the firstborn, right? Guaranteed this inheritance that was so much greater than Jacob. Well, these boys grow up, and as these boys grow up, they have a bit of a rivalry. Esau, he's a man's man, you know? He's hairy, he's a hunter, he's buff. Jacob, he likes to cook, okay? He's hairless, he's very smooth, silky skin, you know what I mean? He likes to sit at home and, you know, watch the bake-offs. That's what he likes to do, okay? So Esau's outside, he's got a beard like Josh Stobart, you know, and he's just very manly. And Jacob sits at home in his skinny jeans, wondering what spices to use. Right? So that's the dynamic between the two. And so one day Esau comes home and he is hungry, right? Boy needs his protein, right? Been doing a lot of CrossFit outside, a lot of tire flips and stuff. And so he is hungry and he needs his protein, he needs his food. And it just so happens Jacob's making a stew, right? Probably chicken broth, very paleo, right? Full of protein. And so he wants some stew. And he's like, Jacob, please give me something to eat, man. I'm so hungry. I've been burning so many calories, bro. You got to hook me up. You know what I mean? Help me out. And Jacob's like, this is my stew. This is my soup. What are you doing? He's like, come on, man, please. And Jacob, probably just kidding, was like, I tell you what, I'll give you this pot of stew for your birthright. And Esau goes, done. Really? Okay, well, here you go. Here's your protein. And back in that time, I mean, that was a deal, right? I mean, when that happened, that meant that it was rock solid. And so a period of time comes by, and it's time for Isaac to pass on the blessing, to do the deed and to say, this is your birthright. Now everything is yours. I pass it on to you. You receive the blessing. And it came time to do that. And Jacob, he was determined that he was going to get what he thought was now his. And so Jacob, with the help of his mother, dressed up like Esau, put animal fur on his body to look hairy. And he goes in Isaac's tent when Isaac was calling for Esau to give him the blessing. And he goes in the tent, he tries to disguise his voice. It doesn't work so well, but the hairy arms pull it all off, right? Because he's like, oh, these aren't silky smooth like your dumb brother, right? These are hairy. You must be Esau with this kind of hair. And so he believes that it is Esau. And guess what Isaac does? He ends up giving Jacob the blessing. He says, here, it's yours. It is now yours. Take it. And Jacob receives the entire inheritance that was supposed to go to Esau. And Esau shows up, and it's too late. Deal is done. Handshake is done. This was a tradition that could not be broken. And Isaac says, I'm sorry. I thought you were your brother, and I ended up giving it to Jacob. And this did not make Esau happy one bit. As a matter of fact, Isaac was about to die. And this is what he said next that he communicated to his brother. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. And he said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, and then I will kill my brother. So he said, look, I'm not going to kill you right now because dad's dying. But as soon as he's dead and we're done mourning, I'm coming after you and you're dead. And I'm taking everything back that you stole from me. And so Jacob had to run. His mother said, you got to get out of here. As soon as Isaac's dead, you're going to die. Your brother's going to kill you. And so he fled. He ran to live with his uncle. Now, this is really where it really gets weird, okay? And so if you ever tell anybody that you're striving to have a biblical family, don't ever say that, okay? Because biblical family, like, doesn't exist in the Bible. There's some creepy stuff that happens in here, all right? You don't ever want to have a biblical family. Because what Jacob ends up doing is he goes and lives with his uncle. And he marries his uncle's daughters, who are sisters. He marries a pair of sisters. Now, some of you may be going, sounds pretty good to me. No, not true, all right? So he ends up marrying his uncle's daughters, two sisters, plus two slaves. Those were the four wives, Rachel, Leah, and two slaves. And so he ends up marrying them. And he takes all this wealth, he takes the inheritance, and things just go super, super well, right? Joseph has his 12 sons that we saw. or Jacob has his 12 sons that we saw. Jacob's one of them. That's the one that was connected with Rachel. He has kids with Leah. He has kids with these two slave women. He has four wives, 12 kids, a ton of cattle, a ton of money, a ton of land. And it gets so crazy and so absurd that his uncle and the rest of the family go, "You got to get out of here. This is, you guys are cramming us. You guys are taking up too much space. This is not what I agreed to when you moved in with me. You got to get out of here. This is just ridiculous. I am tired of you messing around with my daughters and all this weird stuff that's happening in our family. So you got to go." And he didn't have anywhere to go. Anywhere else he would have gone, he would have gotten robbed. He would have gotten murdered. He would have had things taken from him. His only chance he had was to return home. And guess who was waiting for him? Esau. This is many, many years later. But it says next what the Lord told him to do. It said, the Lord said to Jacob, "Go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." Jacob, this is the only shot you've got. Go back to your family. Go back to the land of your ancestors. Go back to Esau, and I will be with you. And he did. And Jacob, he goes home with this caravan of all of his kids and all of his money and all of his stuff, and he goes back. And you got to know that all the family and Joseph and all the brothers, they were told the legend of Uncle Esau. And they were told how Esau and Jacob, they made this deal over this stew, but Jacob ended up having to trick Grandpa Isaac into giving him, you know, this inheritance and stuff. And that's why we don't ever see Uncle Isaac, you know, or Grandpa Isaac or Uncle Esau or any of them, because if we ever did, they would kill us. And so they're all going back and they all know the legend of what happened between Uncle Esau and Dad. And they go back and they're fully expecting to be slaughtered. And they start to come over and they come over this hill. And all of a sudden they look up and on top of this hilltop is Esau with an army of 400 people. Shoot. And Jacob's just ready for it. He's like, "Well, this is it. We're done. Look at, he showed up with an army of 400 people. We are going to get slaughtered. We're going to get murdered. This is it. He told me he was going to kill me, and he is. He's going to kill me." And so then, one by one, he began to line up his family. And I want you to notice what's said here. So next, this is what it tells us. It says, "So Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. And he put the female servants and their children in front. Leah and her children next. And Rachel and Joseph in the rear." So you can tell, again, who his favorites are, right? Okay, slave women up front. Rachel, you come in the back with Joseph, all right? So if this is going to go in order, I want you guys to be spared. But notice, of all the names to mention, okay, this is why I think this is so important and why it's connected. Of all the children to mention, it mentions Joseph. Interesting, right? Of all the people to mention, it mentions Joseph by name. Joseph was there. Joseph saw what happened next. So Jacob went on ahead and bowed down to the ground to his brother. So he goes down and he bows down and he continues to bow down and he continues to bow down. And then this is what happened next when Esau responds to it. "But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and he kissed him, and they wept. And then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. He said, 'Who are these with you?' he asked. And Jacob answered, 'They are the children that God has graciously given your servant.'" And then watch what it says next. And then next, "Then the female servants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. And last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down." Now connect the dots, and let's go back from our flashback. Here is Joseph with his brothers bowed down at his feet. His brothers did him wrong. His brothers tried to kill him. His brothers ruined his life. And now he has their life in his hands. But what does he choose to do? He shows them mercy. And he shows them grace. He decides to forgive them. He has them stand up. He embraces them.
He loves them. He tells him that he is going to take care of them. He says that they will never, ever have to worry about a thing, and that now his brothers will live with him and that he will take care of them. And he tells them to go get Jacob. He tells them to go get the rest of the family. And he says, I have forgiven you. What you did, you meant to harm me, but God meant for good. And he sent me ahead of you so that I could provide for you and I could bless you. Why in the world would Joseph do that? I believe, and I think it's why the writer of Genesis put Joseph's name in that story before, is because in that moment where Joseph had his brothers bow down at his feet with many options ahead of him, what went through his mind is what he remembered seeing when Uncle Esau should have killed his dad, Jacob. But what he remembered in that moment when they were bowed down in the middle of that field, fully expecting to be killed by those 400 men, is when Uncle Esau came and embraced the brother who had done him wrong and kissed him and loved him and took them in and provided for them and took care of them and got them taken care of. I believe he recalled back to what he saw his family do. I think he called back in his mind to the legend of Uncle Esau. And he remembered what he saw. And he said, you know what? It's no different. I have to do for my brothers what I saw Uncle Esau do for his brother as well. Here's the point I'm trying to make. It's going to be on the screen. What your children see you do. Go ahead and put that on the screen. What your children see you do will lay the groundwork for what they do. What your children see you do will lay the groundwork for what they do. Fathers, who do you want your sons to be? Because your sons are watching you right now. And let me tell you something, because you may not be fully aware of it. Right now, your son is watching how to treat a woman, how to speak to a woman, how to fight with a woman, how to disagree with somebody in traffic. And your son is watching you, and you are laying seeds that will bring a harvest in your son's life. And what you do now will have a ripple effect in your son's life one day. Moms, your kids are watching you right now. Your kids are watching you right now. And what's happening right now, your daughters are watching what it looks like to be a wife, what it looks like to be a strong, courageous, independent, loving mother and woman. And they're watching you right now, and they're learning from you, and they're watching what it means and what it looks like to spend money, how to spend money, who to take care of, what it means to have a job, what it means to have a work ethic, how to love people, what it looks like to have a relationship with a man and be a wife. They are looking at you, and guess what? They are going to love the way that you love now. They are going to argue the way that you argue now. They are going to end up parenting the way that you parent. So let me ask you, how do you want your grandchildren to be raised? Because how you raise your daughter right now is how your grandchildren are going to be raised one day. It's going to have a ripple effect. It doesn't just end with you, and what you do matters, because right now, everything you do is planting a seed that will be harvested one day. In the next generation to come, your actions will plant seeds that will be harvested by the next generation. And here's the thing that I think we get so screwed up so many times when we argue about things that are going on in the world, and when we see things like school shootings and terrible things happen, and we talk about this young generation, I can't believe they this and they that. Here's the thing, you need to stop, because you taught the next generation what it looked like to be a man. You're teaching the next generation what it looks like to be a woman. Everything they've learned from you, or what you've allowed in your household and in their ears and in their eyes. They are just repeating what they've seen. And either you showed it to them, or you allowed them to see it. What do you want the next generation to look like? What seeds do you want to plant in their life? Because you will have a legend. You are writing a legend right now, and you will be legendary, and your legend will be told one day. What do you want that legend to be? because it will have an impact on not just the next generation, but the generation to come after that, and your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren. What you do now matters. And you may believe me, you may not. But if you do believe me, don't you think we should do something about it now? If what I said is true, and what happened to Joseph and Esau could happen to us and our family and our context, what things do we need to start doing right now? What things do we need to stop doing right now? Let me pray for you guys. God, this morning, I thank you so much for my family, God. For the family behind me who instilled the principles and values that they were taught. Some of them by family, some of them by pastors, some of them by Sunday school teachers, some of them by good mentors and friends. God, you planted seeds that were harvested in their lives and in their sons and daughters' lives and now in my life. And now, God, I am fully aware that I am planting seeds in my daughter and in my son's life that one day I will see harvested, and it will make an impact, not just in their lives, but in who they marry and how they treat other people and who their kids end up being and what they become. And so, God, this morning, I pray that you would just grab all of us right now and help us to stop thinking of the context that we are just in now, the household that we are under now. But God, will you push our minds and our eyes further than that into what is going to be in the generations to come? God, will you help us understand the ripple effect that our decisions and our actions will have on our sons, on our daughters, on our grandchildren, and on our great-grandchildren, and in all the lives that they will impact and they will interact with as well, God. God, will you right now this morning, will you get a hold of us? Will you show us the places where we should be convicted, the ways that we handle things relationally, the ways that we fight, the ways that we argue, the way that we spend our money, the way that we make decisions? Will you show us the things that we need to change? And God, will you forgive us of the mistakes that we've made? And will you help us turn a corner and be different and be the models, be the Christ-like parents, husbands and wives, children that you intended us to be, God. We love you this morning, and we pray these things in your name. Amen.